take the opportunity to welcome the delegation from the department. My name is Cheta Mofokeng. I am the chairperson of the Select Committee on Security and Constitutional Development. I will hand over to other members of the committee to introduce themselves, and then the leader of the delegation will also introduce the team.
Thank you. I'm Maseman Makurela, eminent member of the Select Committee.
My name is Jack Baker, ik is van Bischkaap, ik is ook deel van die comité.
Good morning, my name is Dennis Bloom and I'm a member of this committee. Thank you very much.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Nongubile Gomsomi. I'm the Director General of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Lawrence Bassett. I'm from the Department of Justice in the Legislation Section.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Ina Kureta from the Department of Justice, also working in Legislative Development within the Legislative Commission.
Good morning, I'm Sandra Solos-Kosan, also from the Department of Justice and Legislative Development.
Good morning, I'm Pat Moodley, Department of Justice. I work in court services, and my chief directive is called the Promotion of the Rights of Vulnerable Groups. Thank you.
My apology, I was with this press people outside. My name is Matomi Humphrey Mohori, member of this committee and chairperson of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs.
My name is Lungisile Pagati, chairperson, Ministry of Justice and Constitutional Development.
Yes, thank you. Blessing Bala, Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
I'm Dadi Saitadeva. I'm with the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office.
I'm also with the Catholic Parliamentary Office.
Thank you very much. Can you continue the presentation?
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members. We are here today to present the regulation to the Child Justice Act. In part, we are here to prepare for the implementation of the Act, which must come into effect by the 1st of April 2010. There are a few things, matters of order, Chair, that I would like to just indicate to the committee so that we find a way forward very quickly. One, we were supposed as the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development to table the regulations before Parliament in December. We did not meet that deadline, and we really want to apologize for that. Due to circumstances beyond our control, we are not able to meet the deadline, but we have since started the process with the our portfolio committee, and we are here then to consult on those regulations. In the consultation process with the portfolio committee after the regulations were tabled, we were advised very strongly that we get a full understanding of this House of the regulations and consult fully and get whatever comments we can still get and be able to factor all comments before the regulations are finalized. So part of this exercise, amongst others, Chair, is to achieve that. I also wish to advise this Honorable House that the departments that are affected by these regulations and by this legislation have all been consulted. We've consulted at length, given the fact that we received guidance from the Portfolio Committee again that if we did not sing in one tune and in symphony around this, we may slander. And so this is one of the responsibilities of the JCPS cluster, which I am chairing. So I have taken personal responsibility to galvanize support behind the regulations and all other elements of documentation that must be in place before the implementation of the legislation. And that includes these regulations present before this Honorable House, the national instructions by the Department of by SAP, as well as the directives which must be issued by the NDCT. So all of that, Chair, all of that work is underway, and we've received all support of the regulation. Chair, even before the regulations are dealt with in specific terms, I also wish to add the following, that we had received comments from the Portfolio Committee on the regulations themselves, some aspects of the regulations, which we've now factored in the regulations that we'll be presenting before this Honorable House. Equally, the sister departments that are affected have given us comments, and we've factored all of the comments. As late as yesterday, we met just to check if we are all in unison, therefore, in tabling these regulations, and I can report comfortably, Chair, that in all the departments that we that are participating in this process, we are in unison in tabling the regulations, and they are fully supported. There were one or two areas, and I will specify those areas for the members so that there's general understanding of where we are still finding each other. One is the area of, in the regulations, we talk about designated probation officers, and the plea from social development was that we omit the word designated for now, go and implement, test if the logistics of that is happening without a failure. If it is, then there is really no need for specifying designated to accompany the word probationary officer. The second element related to excuse me, Chair. The second element that they were concerned with around the regulations was the qualifications, and in that as well, Chair, we have been able to find each other. And insofar as that is concerned, we are happy then that we will be able to move in unison. Having said that, Chair, I will allow then my team members to take the meeting through the regulations themselves, and we will then be honored to receive comments of this House. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to be playing a role in talking to the regulations. My colleague, Ms. Buerta and Ms. Kosana, are going to do that. There are two documents that have been circulated. Chair, the one is the regulations, and then the other one is a much smaller document. The regulations are quite voluminous. The other document is a document setting out all the provisions in the Act which require regulations. It's a useful document in the sense that it gives an indication of what the regulations are required to deal with. The regulations themselves, as our DG has already said, Minister Table, the regulations, the regulations that you have in front of you now are the regulations as amended. It's a later set of regulations, and we've been receiving requests for small amendments here and there, which we are trying to accommodate, because I think all the amendments, even up until the last minute, do improve the document. Just for benefit of members, this latest set of regulations, you'll see that there's underlining words in bold and in square brackets indicating where the changes are. I'd like to think they're not too many. but they all go to contributing, they all contribute to improving the document. So with that as background, Chair, I would like to hand over to my colleagues, and I think Ms. Huerta is going to do an introduction, and Ms. Kusana is going to take us through the detail of the regulations.
Thank you, Lynn. As Mr. Bassett indicated, we deemed it advisable maybe to give the members a brief overview of the Act to facilitate also then the understanding when we deal with the regulation. Now, the objects of the Act are in broad terms to establish a separate criminal justice system for children, a system that will really be aligned with the values of the Constitution and that will also ensure that we can comply with our international obligations. A second important object of the Act is to provide for the minimum age when a child can be held responsible for his or her actions. And in our explanations, we will refer to criminal capacity as being that the child will be able to understand what and distinguish between what is wrong and right and also to act in accordance with that appreciation. Then also what we would like to do is children who cannot be held responsible for their actions will then be dealt with by means of a separate procedure that is contained in the Act. The Act is also all about assessment, an assessment by the probation officer to ensure that the circumstances of the child, the age of the child, are brought to the attention of the prosecutor and the court. Then also what is important, for the first time we will have in statute a provision that will say that there is a requirement for a preliminary inquiry, and I will later then just quickly explain to members what that nearly entails. Then also the Act makes provision for diversion of the children away from the criminal justice system. It's true that presently that is possible, but we do that without a proper framework and without a framework that is designed to look at children specifically. Then what is also important is that we will have for the first time child justice courts to hear all trials of children where the matters have not yet been diverted. And even important is to extend the sentencing options available in respect of children. I think what is important there is also that we may include restorative justice sentences. Now, as a general rule, this Act will apply to any person then who was under the age of 10 years at the time when the offence was committed, but also to a child who was 10 years or older but under the age of 18 when he or she was supposed to appear at a preliminary inquiry for the alleged offence. Now, under certain circumstances, this Act can also apply to other persons who are between 18 and 21, but that is the exception, and I will just leave it there for a moment. Now, what is important is that the Act actually gives a roadmap how to deal with the child, and the roadmap is actually linked to two aspects. First, the age of the child, and secondly, the seriousness of the offence. Now, in the Act, there are three schedules dealing with different categories of offences. The one is the Schedule 1 offence, which is the minor offences like assault, common, and theft under a certain amount, etc. Schedule 2 is the more serious offences. And then Schedule 3 is really the most serious offences where you deal with rape and abduction and murder, for instance. Now, to explain the Act, I think it's important just to look at three categories of children. The first is children under the age of 10 years, in which case the children will never land up within the criminal justice system the way in which we understand it. The child will be apprehended by the police official, and then the child will be referred to the probation officer in terms of the Act, and the probation officer will decide how to deal with the child, whether it be a referral to the children's court because the child is in need of care, or to arrange support programs for the child. child or whatever the case may be. Then the second category is where the child is between 10 years and 14 years of age. And the whole issue here is to say that in that age group, the state has to prove that this particular child has the capacity to understand what is the right and wrong and to act in accordance with that appreciation. If the state cannot prove that, then we will deal with the child as if the child is under the age of 10 years. If the state can then approve the criminal capacity of the child, then the child will be dealt with in the way in which the act sets up. Now, here, to facilitate this age determination in the act, provision is made for different ways, like the age estimation by the probation officer, but also by a referral to a medical practitioner to determine the age of the child. And then also in regard to criminal capacity in itself, the Act does allow for a referral to competent persons to conduct this evaluation. Now, in the case where the child is 14 years of older, that is now the first group, or where the child is between 10 years and under age of 14, but it was found that the child has criminal capacity, then we look at different processes in the Act. The first is the assessment, which I've already drawn your attention to, which is done by the probation officer, where the child will then be assessed, either given a summons or arrested, but that is just as an exception, or given a written warning to appear before a magistrate for preliminary inquiry. Now, just to take you back to the assessment, the purpose of this assessment is to establish whether the child is in need of care and protection in order to refer the child, as I've already to some extent indicated. Then also is to see whether you can divert the mass, and I will soon tell you more about the diversion options and what is the purpose of the diversion. Then also to look at the age of the child, and also to formulate recommendations whether the child should be released or detained, because the Act, in terms of the Act, it's the last resort to detain a child. Now, in the preliminary inquiry, what will happen is there's a kind of an informal setting. It's not a court as usual business as we understand court. Informal setting, which will be in the form of a pre-trial, where the magistrate is really required to play an active role, unlike in the normal court where we see that there's a kind of a more that the prosecutor and the defense plays a major role. Now, one of the objectives of this preliminary inquiry is then to look at the assessment report of the probation officer and then to decide which way to go with the child. And then what is important throughout the Act is to say is you can always have a look at diversion. Even if it's post-preliminary inquiry, it can be done by a prosecutor, but it must be made in order of the court, of course. Then secondly, at the preliminary inquiry, the magistrate can still decide then to divert the child. Then when the case has started in the, as a trial in the children's court, in the child justice court, at that point in time, but before the close of the state case, then the child can still be diverted. So the whole idea is to see to what extent it's possible to divert a child. Now, insofar as diversion then is concerned, is just to make a few remarks about what are the options and what does it entail. Now, as already indicated, this diversion is a key feature of the Act, and we get diversion options at two levels. The one is the level one option, which is meant to apply or be applied in respect of the Schedule 1 offences, the minor offences, which include an oral apology or written apology and referral of the child for counselling or therapy. Now, then the second level is for the second level of diversion options is then for the Schedules 2 and 3 offences, which are then becoming more serious offences. And that includes compulsory attendance at a specific centre for educational or vocational purposes, and it may also include temporary residence or placement under supervision by a probation officer. Now, the period of diversion also differs. You can make a diversion order for 12 months. You can make a diversion order for 24 months, for up to 48 months, depending on what is the nature of that specific program, and then secondly, what is the offense for which the child is now being, so to speak, held accountable. Then in the Child Justice Court, where we get the trial, the whole purpose here is to make sure that the child understands the implications of what he or she has done, and also to be held accountable for the harm caused. Then also what we try to do is to have an individualized response, meaning you look at the child's circumstances, you look at the interest of society, and you look at the offense. Now, the act is also all about the reintegration of the child into the family and back into society. And also the sentences that we look at is really using imprisonment as a measure of last resort, and if it appears that that's the only way, then to look at the shortest term possible. Now, the Act provides, as I indicated, for new kind of sentences, and I've already alluded to the community-based sentence, such as compulsory school attendance order, placement under supervision and by a probation officer, and then very importantly also your restorative justice sentences, where we look at a victor-offender mediation, where you bring the offender and the victim together and see to what extent you can restore the relationship, and also then family group conferences, which is then also very important. Now, when you look at the Act, one will realize that you don't have one Act dealing with all aspects of a trial of investigation. You need to look at the Act in conjunction with the Children's Act and to a great extent also to the Criminal Procedure Act. That's why when you look at the Act, you will see there's a Schedule 4, which maps out the interface between the Child Justice Act and also the Criminal Procedure Act. And when this Act was passed by Parliament or during the deliberations, it was that Parliament felt it very important to always have fallback positions in the event that the procedures and processes, which were considered to be important for the benefit of children, they cannot be complied with. Now, insofar as the regulations are concerned, it's important consultation, as the DG has already indicated. Consultation is very important, not only because the Act requires us to do that, but also to make sure that everybody is on board and that there will be effective and efficient implementation of the Act. But when we draft the regulations, we also had a specific approach towards doing that, and I just would like to take the members through a few principles that we applied, so that I think that you will be able to understand why there are, for instance, certain gaps. When you look at the regulations, you will think there's a gap, but there's a lot that will supplement, again, the regulations. For instance, in terms of the Act, there are national instructions that need to be issued by the National Commission of Police pertaining to the specific aspects relating to the work of police. Then in addition, what you have is you have directives that must be issued by the National Director of Public Prosecution. So when you look at this whole package, you have the Act, you have the regulations, you have the directives, you have the national instructions, and then, of course, there's always, you know, administrative procedures that have been always there and that will apply in any event. Now, in that regard, we did not want to over-regulate as well. We had a look at the Act and we realized there's a lot of sections in the Act that tells us that we must make regulations. We have got a list, and that is the list that I think that has been distributed to you. That is the list that guided us in drafting the regulation. The second thing is that insofar as forms are concerned, that lately we are always inundated with requests to prescribe forms, which we also understand the reason for that. But what sometimes is problematic is you need a form to ensure consistency and correct application.
But sometimes it's difficult to prescribe a form by means of regulation. And why is that? Firstly, because you don't want to constrain the creativity of a person who writes, for instance, a report. So that you want to make sure that this person, because of the specific fact before this probation officer, that that probation officer can really have freedom in writing the report and not be stifled by what we've got in the regulation. The other possibility was to say is there's nothing in the Act that prevents anybody to develop a form, to use it as an administrative form, and should there amendments be required, then we can do it easily and we don't have to follow the long process of going through a parliamentary processes to deal with that. Then also there's a lot of sections in the Act requiring more or less the same kind of provisions, and you will pick it up when Tando takes you through that. And that is that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. As the DC has already indicated, there have been changes that have been suggested to the draft regulation as it was tabled, and this will be discussed as I look at each particular regulation. I will begin with Chapter 1. Chapter 1 of the regulation contains two regulations. Regulation 1, which deals with the definition. And the definitions, we try to rely mostly to the definition in terms of the Act. The definitions that are in the regulations are just to take further the definitions that are in the Act. And the regulation 2 was the regulations where we made provision for the Director General of Social Development to designate probation officers. But as the DC has already indicated, there has been suggestions that have been raised by the Department of Social Development, so I'm not going to take this regulation that much. And then looking at Chapter 2 of the regulations, it contains regulations regarding the criminal capacity of children and also the other matters which are related to age. Now, Section 9 of the Act, which deals with the manner of dealing with a child which is under the age of 10, which is the child that cannot be prosecuted as it is taken that the child lacks criminal responsibility. The Act requires the Minister to prescribe the manner in which the police official must deal with this child if the child is alleged to have committed an offence. In terms of the Act, the police official must hand over the child either to the parent or to the child in youth care center, and we have to prescribe the manner in which the child must be handed. So Regulation 3 deals with the manner of handing over a child. And the regulation sets out what exactly should how exactly should the police official hand over the child, like establishing a relationship with the person to whom the child is going to be handed, and the child, and informing that person of the alleged offence, and explaining the procedure that should be followed in terms of the Act. There is also an emphasis on the fact that the police official must, when doing this, handing over the child, use plain languages, which takes into account the age and the maturity of the child. The police official must also make sure that the person who is to receive the child is aware of the responsibilities in terms of the Act and is willing to accept those responsibilities. And then Regulation 4 of the regulation deals with the manner in which the police official must notify a probation officer. In terms of the Act, the police official must, after handing over the child to the parent or child and youth care center, must then notify the probation officer who will take the process further. And then in terms of the Act, we are required to prescribe the manner in which the police official must notify the probation officer. And the regulation 4 then provides that the police officer must either hand or fax the notice to the police officer and must make sure that the police, the probation officer receives the notice. Section 9(3) of the Act then sets out the manner in which the probation officer must deal with a child, the child that is under the age of 10 that cannot be prosecuted. And then in terms of the Act, we are required to prescribe the manner in which the probation officer must deal with that child, such as referring a child to a children's court or referring a child for counseling or therapy. Regulation 5 deals with the manner of referring a child to a children's court. Regulation 6 then regulates the referral of a child to counseling or therapy. And Regulation 7 deals with referring a child to an accredited program. We have actually designed a form that the probation officer may use in referring a child to these different institutions. And the probation officer will then, after assessing the child, complete this form and then attach the assessment form and then refer the child either to the children's court or for counseling or therapy. The probation officer may also refer a child for support services, and that is regulated in Regulation 8. And for the purposes of support services, we had regulated that the designated probation officer is to compile a database of services that is available in that particular area to be able to enable the probation officer to refer the children. This regulation is also going to be re-looked at because of Regulation 2. Then Regulation 9 deals with arranging a meeting for a child, which is one of the decisions that the probation officer can take. In terms of this, the probation officer must arrange a meeting. And the purpose of the meeting is to formulate a written plan on how to deal with the child. Regulation 11 deals with what should actually be the content of that written plan. Then Regulation 11 deals with the information and sexual details that must be taken into account by the probation officer when deciding to take no action. One of the different options that the probation officer can do after assessing the child is to decide that there's no need to take any action against the child. And we also require, in terms of the Act, to prescribe the manner in which the probation officer should go about when deciding not to take an action. So just in that Regulation 11 set out what the probation officer must take into account when he or she decides to take no action. And in terms of Section 9(6) of the Act, the probation officer is required to record the outcome of the assessment, and we are required to prescribe the manner in which that outcome must be recorded. And that is regulated in Regulation 12, which deals with the manner of recording the outcome of the assessment and the decision taken by the probation officer. And then Section 11 of the Act, which is the section that deals with criminal capacity. As we have already indicated, that the child who is 10 but under the age of 14 is presumed to have criminal capacity. Not to have criminal capacity, but until the state must prove that the child has criminal capacity. So in terms of Section 11, we are required to prescribe the manner in which such a child may be referred to a suitable qualified person to assist the court in evaluating the criminal capacity of a child. This is regulated in Regulation 14, in Regulation 13, I beg your pardon, which provides the manner in which such an order may be made by the court. And we have actually designed a form in terms of which the court will make the order and then refer the child for the evaluation of criminal capacity. Then Regulation 14 and 15 deals with the age determination, as it has already been indicated that there may be instances where the child, the age of the child is not certain. So Section 13 of the Act requires that the probation officer, while doing assessment, if the age of the child is not certain, the probation officer must make the determination. And we have, in terms of Regulation 14 and 15, designed a form that the probation officer may fill in. And in terms of 15, the form that that will be filled in to refer a child to a medical practitioner for the purposes of determining the age of a child. Then Chapter 3 of the regulation deals with the manner of bringing a child to a preliminary inquiry. It provides three methods of bringing a child to preliminary inquiry, which may be a written notice, a summons, or arrest. And then in terms of the Act, a police official must inform and warn and explain to the child certain issues in a prescribed manner. And then Regulation 16, 17, and 18 regulates how should the police official go about explaining and informing the child. Again, the emphasis again is on the police official using plain language, simple vocabulary, and taking into account the age and maturity and the intellectual capacity of the child and the parents. That is Chapter 3. Then Chapter 4 deals with the release or detention and placement of a child. The Act requires that the child who has been arrested must be released unless there are two reasons. Say, if a child is going to be a danger to himself or to the public, or the parents cannot be located. And in terms of Section 22, then, if the child has not been released, the police officer must compile a report to the inquiry magistrate explaining the reason why the child was not released. And Section 22 requires this to be done in a prescribed manner. Regulation 19 then sets out what should be contained in the report, which may include the reasons why the child was not released, and also to include the full details on how, what attempts were made to try to locate the parents, if the reason that the child was not released was that the parent cannot be located. And then in terms of Section 24, a child that has been released, if the child fails to appear in court or fails to comply with the conditions that have been set down, the person who is in to whom the child was released must then notify the court, and we are required to prescribe the manner in which the person must notify the court, and this is regulated in Regulation 20. For this purpose, the person who is in to whom the child has been released must notify. Must notify the court by way of an affidavit, which may be submitted in different ways by the investigating or to the investigating police official or to the clerk of the court. Section 28 of the Act also requires that if a child is in detention in police cell, and then the child complains that he or she has been injured or he suffers a severe psychological trauma, the child must report this to the police official, who must report this. Then in terms of Section 28, we are required to prescribe the manner in which such a complaint must be recorded. And this is provided for in Regulation 21. Which provides that the complaint must be in the form of a report, and it must, and also the regulation sets out what should go into that report. Regulation 21 also provides certain details that must be recorded in the register for the detained children, which is NVSH, or which is provided for in section 20.28.3 of the Act. There is also provision made for the details to be recorded by the station commissioner. This regulation also indicates that the report that has been compiled must be forwarded in a prescribed manner to the national commissioner. There has been proposals that has been made, that has been received to this regulation. In the proposal that has been made, provision is made for a copy of the report to be submitted to the independent complaints directorate. Section 28 also requires that each station commissioner must keep a register for all the children that are detained in his or her police station. And then we are required to prescribe the details of that register. That this is regulated in Regulation 22, which sets out the details and the contents of the register. The regulation also regulates access to that register. And access is divided into two categories. There is direct access by officials who are involved in the matter or when they are exercising their duties, and any other person who wishes to access the register must then do it in writing and address the written request to the station commissioner, who will then consider the request. And then Section 29 of the Act requires us to prescribe a sworn statement that will deal with the availability of accommodation in a child and youth care center. If I may just go a little bit forward, during the assessment, the probation officer must indicate in the assessment report that if the child is going to be placed in a child and youth care center, is the accommodation available in the child and youth care center. So this must be done by means of a sworn statement. So in Regulation 23, we have prescribed the form, which is in a form of a sworn statement that may be completed by the person who is in charge of the child and youth care center. Section 21 of the 31 of the Act deals with a situation where there has been an error regarding the placement of a child. And then the section requires that if there is an error, the person who is receiving the child must refer the child back to court. And then we are required to prescribe the manner of referring this child back to court. Then this is regulated in Regulation 24. Which regulates how a child should be referred back to the presiding officer. In essence, the regulation provides that the referral must be done in writing and must contain certain particulars and must be handed to the presiding officer. It also indicates that who will be responsible to transport the child back to court. There has also been minor technical amendments that has been suggested to Regulation 24. Regulation 25 concerns Section 23 of the Act, 33 of the Act, which requires that where a police official has not been able to transport a child separately from the adult, then the police official must write a report, submit a written report to the presiding officer explaining or setting out the reasons why the child was not transported separately. Then Regulation 25 regulates the content of such a report, which includes the reasons why the child was not transported separately, and also the police official must indicate in that report attempts that were made to try and transport the child separately from adults. There were also technical amendments that have been suggested to this regulation. Now, Chapter 5 of the regulation, which deals with the assessment of a child. in terms of Section 39 of the Act, a probation officer must also inform and explain particular issues to the child in a prescribed manner. This is regulated in Regulation 26 of the Act, which sets out how the probation should go about informing the child. This is during the process of assessment. Again, there is also emphasis on the language used by the probation officer, which must take into account the age and the maturity of the child, giving the child sufficient information and also verifying with the child whether the child understands the information given. In terms of Section 40 of the Act, we are required to prescribe the manner in which the probation officer must complete the assessment form after assessing the child. And this is regulated in Regulation 27, which sets out the manner in which the probation officer should complete the assessment report, such as requiring the probation officer to indicate the information that was received during the assessment and also to indicate how did he or she arrive at the outcome of the assessment and the recommendation made. At this point, I must mention that we haven't developed a form that will be used as an assessment report. And the reason was that some of the commenters have indicated that the form may restrict the creativity of the person who's writing the report, as it has already been mentioned. However, the Department of Social Development, which will be dealing with this particular issue, may develop a pro forma that they may use in practice, which they will be able to amend if there is a need to amend the form. And then Chapter 6 of the regulations deals with this stage of the preliminary inquiry. In terms of Section 47 of the Act, the inquiry magistrate is required also to inform and to explain certain issues to the child, and this must be done in the prescribed manner, which has been prescribed in Regulation 28 of the Act. Again, the emphasis here is on the language that will be used by the inquiry magistrate when explaining to the child, which must take into account the age and the maturity of the child, giving sufficient information and also verifying with the child whether he or she understands the information. Then Chapter 7 of the regulations deals with diversion. There are different diversion options that are listed in Section 53 of the Act. And the section requires these diversion options to be issued in a prescribed manner, which is then regulated by Regulation 29. We have actually designed a form consisting of different parts of the orders that may be issued in terms of that section, which will then be issued by the presiding officer, because our understanding that the presiding officer may issue more than one order. Then Section 56 of the Act requires the cabinet member responsible for social development in consultation with the cabinet member, with other cabinet members, to establish and maintain a system of accreditation of diversion programs and diversion service provider, and this must be done in the prescribed manner, which we have then prescribed in Regulation 30. Regulation 30 contains provision to ensure that resources are available for diversion programs. It provides that the minister must ensure that there are sufficient funds and may also set out systems and procedures to obtain necessary funding if that's necessary, and to monitor the expenditure. The provisions of these regulations were to a greater extent are aligned to the provisions of the Public Finance Management Act and the regulations issued in terms of that Act. Regulation 56.2b requires us to prescribe the manner in which the cabinet member responsible for social development must establish a system of accreditation and maintain that system. However, However, we did not prescribe anything because our feeling was that this issue is sufficiently covered in the Act. And also the Minister for Social Development is also required to provide a policy framework with regard to this particular issue, and we said that it would be whatever is not covered in the Act may be covered in the policy framework. And Section 56.2E of the Act requires the Minister of Social Development to issue a certificate of accreditation, and we were required to prescribe this certificate. This we have done in Regulation 31. We have prescribed a form that we have designed the form that will be used as a certificate. And Section 56.2G of the Act requires us to prescribe the manner in which quality assurance processes must be done. This has been done in Regulation 32. This regulation requires that quality assurance processes must be conducted by a panel, and it also regulates the composition of that panel. The regulations also set out the process that must be followed in preparing the report after the quality assurance process has been done, which is to a greater extent aligned to the provisions of the draft regulations in terms of the Children's Act. Section 56 and 58 of the Act deals with the compliance of a child with their diversion order. In terms of Section 57, if the child fails to comply with a diversion, the probation officer or any other person that may be appointed by the court to monitor the child's compliance must then notify the court, which must be done in a prescribed manner. This we have prescribed in Regulation 33. Regulation 33 deals with non-compliance. In terms of this regulation, the inquiry magistrate or child justice court must be notified by way of a form which has been prescribed in the regulation, and the probation officer must, when a child has successfully complied with the diversion also, with the diversion order, also submit a report to the relevant prosecutor, who will in turn submit that report to the clerk of the court. Some amendments have also been suggested in terms of this of Regulation 33. In terms of this amendment, there is a provision made to notify the probation. For the probation officer to notify the magistrate within 7 days after the child has failed to comply with the diversion order. Then, in terms of Section 61 of the Act, the Director General for Social Development is required also to maintain a register for children that has been diverted. And this, we have to prescribe the details of the register, which has been done in Regulation 35 and 36. Regulation 35, the Director General for Social Development must designate an official to make entries or to coordinate the register. The regulation also sets out the procedure of how to deal with diversion orders that are received, and a proposal has also been made to amend the Regulation 35. Then Regulation 36 regulates the register, regulates access to the register. A person who wishes to access this register for diversion must complete a form. The person in charge of the register will then consider the application and decide whether to grant or not to grant access to the register. And then Chapter 8 is now at the stage of a child justice court. In terms of Section 63, the presiding officer at a child justice court is also required to inform and explain the nature of the allegations to the child and his or her rights in a prescribed manner. And this is regulated in Regulation 37, which sets out how the presiding officer should inform and explain to the child. The regulation provides, among other issues, that the presiding officer must use simple and plain language, take into account the age, maturity, and the stage of development of the child. In terms of Section 65 of the Act, every district court magistrate is required to keep a list of independent observers. And where a child appears in a child justice court and the child does not have his or her parents with him and requests the court that he or she needs assistance, the court may appoint an independent observer to assist the child. And then we are required in terms of the Act then to prescribe the manner on which how this the list of the independent observers should be complied. And this is regulated in Regulation 39 up until Regulation 40. Regulation 38 requires that nomination must be made, and we have designed a form to be used for nomination, which must be completed by the person who's doing the nomination, and the person who is nominated must then accept the nomination in the form. There has also been an amendment that has been suggested in terms of this regulation. The suggestion is that we must make provision for other means of communication in respect of the invitation for nomination, like advertising it in the newspapers, and that we must also allow persons to be able to nominate themselves. And then Regulation 39 includes the person's language and his or her occupation, social interests, and the background. The Regulation 39 deals with what will be reflected in the list when the list is completed. And in addition to the name of the person who has been nominated as an independent observer, we must also include the person's language and his or her occupation. This information will assist the presiding officer in making an informed decision when appointing an independent observer. Regulation 40 deals with specifically with the appointment by the court and places an obligation on the presiding officer to ensure that a suitable person is appointed to assist the child and that the child is willing to accept that person to assist him or her. Chapter 9 of the regulations deals with sentencing. Now, in terms of Section 72, 73, and 74 of the Act, which deals with community-based sentence, a restorative justice sentence, or a fine, the court must, when imposing a community-based sentence or a restorative justice sentence, must request the probation officer to monitor the child, whether the child complies with the sentence, and must then the probation officer must then report back to the court. And then we are required to prescribe the manner in which the probation officer must report back to the court, which is then done in Regulation 41. Regulation 41 requires that the report, which is in case of a community-based sentence, must indicate the progress that has been made by the child in complying with that order and whether the objectives of sentencing have been complied with. A proposal has also been made to amend this regulation, and the proposal was to put in place mechanisms to strengthen the monitoring of the child compliance. Provision has been made in the amendment that the court must give direction to the probation officer and also to monitor the child and how to complete the report when he or she is reporting back to court. And Regulation 42 and 43 deals with the same issue, but with regard to Regulation 42, with regard to a restorative justice sentence, and the provisions of Regulation 41 will also apply in case of Regulation 42 and 43 with changes that may be required. And then in terms of Section 76 of the Act, a child may be sentenced to compulsory residence in a child and youth care center. And in terms of this section, a child may spend part of the sentence in the child and youth care center, and depending on the offense, the child, when he or she turns 21, may have to complete part of the sentence in prison. And then we are then required, in terms of this section, to prescribe a report that the head or the person who is in charge of the child and youth care center must comply to notify or to notify the court whether the child may be released after spending the sentence of the child and youth care center, or it's still necessary that the child must spend the rest of the sentence in imprisonment. This is then regulated in Regulation 44. Regulation 44 provides the contents of the report, what should be contained in that report, and also the procedures on how to submit that report to the Child Justice Court. We have actually designed a form, and in terms of this form, the head of the Child and Youth Care Center must, amongst other things, indicate whether the objectives of the Act, which are set out in Section 69 of the Act, have been complied with, and also then make recommendations regarding the rest of the sentence. Regulation 45 sets out the procedure of taking the child to a child and youth care center. This is still the child who has been sentenced to compulsory residence in a child and youth care center. And Regulation 45 then provides how a child should be taken to a child and youth care center, which includes that the child must be put under proper control by means that are least evasive and in a manner that will take into account the safety of the child and also the safety of the community. Regulation 46 still deals with a child who has been sentenced to compulsory residence in a child and youth care center. But in terms of this, we have to prescribe the manner in which the court order must be brought to the attention of the child and youth care center. So provision is made that the date on which the child will complete the sentence at the center must be recorded. The clerk of the court must record that, so as to be able to remind the center when the report is due, which must be provided within 6 weeks to enable the court to make a decision whether the child may be released or the child still needs to finish part of the sentence in prison. And then Section 479 of the Act deals with a situation where a child who has been sentenced to a community-based sentence, a restorative justice sentence, or a fine, has failed to comply with a particular sentence. The probation officer who has been identified to monitor the child must then notify the court of the failure and must do so in a prescribed manner. This is prescribed in terms of Regulation 47, which regulates the procedure of reporting to court and bringing the child back to court. Because of the amendment that has been suggested in terms of Regulation 41, there was a need to also make some amendments in terms of Regulation 47, because it also deals with the monitoring of a child. But then Chapter 10 of the Regulation deals with legal representation. In terms of Section 83 of the Act, a child that appears in a child justice court and declines to have a legal representative the court in that situation may, on its own, appoint a legal representative to assist the court, then we are required in terms of that section to prescribe the manner in which such a legal representative should assist the court. This we have prescribed in Regulation 48, which gives such a legal representative certain powers to be able to assist the court, such as being able to address the court or having access to the documents and to the docket. An amendment has also been proposed in terms of this regulation, and the idea was to make it clear when such a legal representative, which is appointed by the court, should be present in court. The amendment allows the court to give direction as to when such a legal representative should be in court. Chapter 11 of the regulations deals with the expungement of records of certain convictions and sentences. In terms of the Act, a child who has been sentenced to a Schedule 1 offense, Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 offense, may apply for his conviction or her conviction and sentence to be set aside. And we are required in terms of the Act to prescribe a form which may be used to apply for such an expungement. An application may also be made to the minister if the child has not sentenced to a Schedule 1 and 2 offense but has not finished 5 and 10 years that are required in terms of the Act. So we have, in terms of Regulation 49, Article 51, we have designed an application form that may be used to apply either to the DG or to the minister. And we have tried, to the extent possible, to align the application procedure for expungement to the procedure for expungement in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. Section 87 also requires the minister to prescribe the manner in which the records must be expunged, which is then regulated in terms of Regulation 52. This regulation empowers the Director General of Social Development to obtain information from other organs of the state or private persons regarding the expungement of a diversion order. It also sets out the process that must be followed if the requirements are not met. If I may just mention that in terms of this regulation, diversion orders may be expunged if a child turns 21 and if a child has not committed another offense in the process. So the regulation allows the Director General of Social Development to be able to obtain information as to whether the child has or has not committed other offences in the process and then be able to expand the record. The last chapter 12, contains miscellaneous provisions. The first regulation deals with the issue of the recording of the age. In terms of Section 90 of the Act, it is required that where the court has made an age determination, that information must be forwarded to the Department of Home Affairs to be able to consider whether to register the child and to issue the child with any form of documentation. And then in terms of Section 90, the minister is required to prescribe the manner in which the Department of Home Affairs must report back on what has been done with the information that has been referred to them. This is regulated in Regulation 53, which regulates the manner in which the Department of Home Affairs must report back. It is provided in this regulation that the department must report back within 30 days after it has been given the forms, and it must also indicate what steps were taken to register or if it was not registered, the reasons why the information, the age of the child was not registered. Section 97(6) of the Act requires the Director General of Social Development to keep a register of children that has been dealt with in terms of Section 9. As we indicated earlier, that Section 9 deals with children under the age of 10 who cannot be prosecuted but who must be dealt with by a probation officer in different ways. So the Director General of Social Development is required to keep a register for those children, and this must be done in a prescribed manner. This is then regulated in terms of Regulation 54 and 55, which regulates the procedure in terms of which the probation officer must, after making this decision in terms of Section 9, then submit that information to the Director General for the purposes of entering or compiling the register. The regulation also regulates how and who can access that register, and this register was also prepared in line with the diversion, with the regulation that regulates access to the diversion register in terms of Regulation 22. Regulation 56 provides a general provision with regard to submitting the notices. Throughout the Act, there is a need for one official to notify the other official or to submit certain information. So we have made a general provision on how the such notices should be submitted, which may be by means of hand delivery, registered post, or electronically. The last regulation, 57, contains the short title and the commencement of the Act. I must just also mention that there are a number of forms that have been developed in terms of the regulation, which were highlighted as the regulation were discussed.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, we can engage with the report. Honorable Makhubela, Honorable Bloom. In that way. But before that, chapter two of the report talks about the referral, and chapter 9, which talks about the sentencing. Can you elaborate on the referral? Does it mean the separation and removal of the child from the parents or the family environment, and how long will the child be expected to stay in those centers? And what are the implications of a child staying in the center with regard to the rehabilitation program? Because some of these centers are not all over, almost in every township. You find a situation where a child has to be taken to a center very far away from the parents and from the family. How will that assist in the rehabilitation of a child when he is not when he is far from the parents? Honorable Makhubela.
No, thanks, Chair. I'm having 62 questions. Or is it on a lighter note? First of all, I would like to ask the following question. The assessment of a child by a first encounter person to a scene of crime,
Here we talk about the age, but not considering anything to mental capacity of that person, the intellectual of that particular person, because of the background. How will you go about assessing such particular child? Is there any formula to be followed in order to determine the background of that person, including the parent where he or she grew up? The definition of plain language. What do you mean by plain language? Can we get clarity? You know, sometimes it will come clear. The burden of proof by the state about the criminal capacity of that particular child. Because they are saying he who asserts must prove. What yardstick are they going to use in order to determine that this child comprehend what he or she has committed? It was mentioned about the when you are referring a child to a place, but we talk about the accommodation. Is there any accommodation for a suitable accommodation for a child? That is a suitable accommodation or any other, because probation or police can just take a child anywhere, but it must be a suitable place for a child. What type of accommodation? The monitoring of compliance. I'm just sort of slightly worried today because remember, it's a child. You are going to assess the compliance. How will you go about what criteria are you going to use to check on this man's compliance? Because a child will just do things as long as it's sort of what is the criteria? There's something about that proposal which you said a copy should be sent to the ICT. That proposal, what is the content of that thing? What are you prescribing, or what are you saying to the ICD? Is there any? So you said one copy to the ICD, I'm sure one copy to the National World Public Prosecution. Yes. I think I'm okay. Thanks.
Before Honorable Bloom. A follow-up to a question asked by Honorable Mark Kubela regarding the proof of guilt or innocence of a child. I am not ignorant of the fact that young children find themselves in conflict with the law, and in some cases with a very serious crime. But the child will remain a child compared to in your process of consultation and maybe studies compared to other countries. How would you rate us as a country? Are our children so bad that we have to sit down and make laws that will confine them to rehabilitation centers? Honorable Bloom.
Thank you very much, Shepperson. Shepperson, it's questions for clarification. The first one is, when is this act supposed to be implemented? That's the first one. The second one is, all the departments that is involved and mentioned in this document, are they on board, and what are their comments? Are they ready this task, all the departments that you have mentioned here. And the third one is the age determination of a child. I see that you are saying in 14.2d that a medical practitioner must do that. You know, that is a very difficult one to determine the age of a I'm talking out of experience. A child is 14 years of age, and that child will say it's 16 years or 17 years to go to prison, not to be amongst children. How are we going to really do that? Is it practical that we are going to get it right?
You can respond.
Chairperson, may I suggest that an approach to the responses to the questions on the technical questions, my team members on the other side of us will respond specifically to the technical ones. On the question that was raised by the last member, Honorable Mr. Bloom, in terms of the readiness of the department, I would request to deal with that as well as the date of coming into implementation of the Act. Thank you. I'll request my colleagues to start with their questions. I'll respond last. Thank you.
I'll start with a question regarding the referral in terms of Section 9. If I understand the question correctly, the question is whether a child who is dead within terms of Section 9 is removed from the parent. Okay. The section provides for two scenarios. Here we are talking about the child who's under the age of 10, who can thus not be prosecuted. So then if it's alleged that this child has committed an offense, the police official may do two things, hand the child to the parents or appropriate adult or guardian in terms of the act, and if these cannot be located or if they can be located but it is not in the best interest of the child, then the child may be handed to a child in youth care center. My understanding is that in terms of the Children's Act, they are child in youth care centers and they are designed in such a way that they provide different programs depending on the age of a child and depending on the issue with the child. And then after handing over the child, the police official must then notify the probation officer who will then assess the child and then make a decision whether to refer. If she finds that the child in need of care and protection, then refer a child to a children's court. Then the child is then, if the child was handed to the parents, is not removed, but will only go and attend the court and will be, the issue will eventually depend on the decision of the court, or may refer a child for counseling or accredited program, which also doesn't require the child to be removed from the parents, but also that will depend where was the child initially handed to, was the child handed to the parents or was the child handed to the child and youth care center.
Just to add to that, the Children's Act will govern circumstances under which children are removed. In this instance, if it is found, for instance, that a child has stolen a loaf of bread, then and the child is below the age of 10 years old, then the police officer is immediately alerted to the fact that this is an economic need. That child is feeling that because there's nobody else who's providing him or her with food or an item of clothing, that kind of thing. That will alert the police official and the probation officers to the fact that this is very possibly a child in need of care who doesn't have that home and nurturing and things that he should be having. And that's when the child will be referred. But the referrals and then what the children's court decides in respect of how to take care of that child will be determined by the Children's Act, which is a separate piece of legislation.
Okay, we'll continue.
Okay, on the question of assessment and determining the background of the child, I think the idea is that before the child appears in court or before a decision is made on how to deal with the child, there must be assessment. And one of the purposes of assessment is to establish exactly the background of the child. The probation officer, I guess, in doing assessment will interview, speak to the child, and will also speak to any other person that may be able to give them information with regard to the background of the child. With regard to plain language, I guess we mean that, as we say, that the language that you use must take into account the age of the child. Like the issue of criminal capacity, the child will not understand. So when talking to the child, the probation officer or the police officer or the presiding officer must use the language that will be able or put him or herself into the shoes of the child, that the child will be able to understand. Regarding the burden of proof, initially the state is required to prove prove whether the child has or doesn't have criminal capacity. And in order to assist the state, Section 11 allows that the court may, on its own, refer the child to a medical practitioner, to a suitable qualified person to be able to evaluate the criminal capacity of a child, or that may be done at the request of the legal representative of the child, and or at the request of the prosecutor. And then the Act also requires the minister to identify categories of persons who will be able to do that. And in terms of the draft notice, we have identified that it's psychologists and psychiatrists who may be able to assist the court in evaluating the criminal capacity of a child. The court will then refer a child to these categories of people who will then assess the child and then compile a report to court advising the court as to the criminal capacity of the child.
Before Tanda finishes off, is that in terms of the Act, the Department of Justice is also required to submit to Parliament after 5 years a report indicating whether or not the current age of criminal capacity is one that best applies to South African children, or is there a need for us to either raise that age of criminal capacity or lower that age of criminal capacity. So for the next 5 years, we need to put in place a research program that tests the age of criminal capacity of a child. Should it be where it is now in terms of this Act?
I want to come in on criminal capacity. I don't think it was mentioned, but I might have missed it. Section 11.1 says the state must prove beyond reasonable doubt the capacity of a child who is 10 years or older. So it's beyond reasonable doubt. I think, sir, what yardstick is going to be used to prove it. And it's beyond reasonable doubt. It's a burden of proof that is used in all criminal proceedings. So I think it's something that the courts and people in the administration of justice are very familiar with. It's not something foreign to them, but it's beyond reasonable doubt. So it's just
Chairperson, there's still two questions. The one is, Mr. Makubele asked about the accommodation, whether there's any kind of accommodation or suitable. I think that when we refer to that, it was with reference when there's a recommendation from the probation officer that this child, for whatever reason, will not be placed in the care of the parent or whatever, that this child must go to a child and youth care center. Now, what the Act is saying is that before the magistrate just merely accept that recommendation, the magistrate must make sure that there is accommodation in the most suitable centre for the child, meeting the age of the child, etc., and also, what is important, the facility, that you don't want to, if this child is really a very violent child, that you must make sure that that accommodation is in line with the need to keep the child out of trouble. Then also, insofar as the ICD is concerned, the regulations did not, the initial ones as tabled, did not provide that a copy of that complaint, if a child is injured or is severely traumatized, that a copy of that complaint must be referred to the ICD. And during our deliberations in the other committee, the need was mentioned that we must make provision for that. It's true that in terms of the legislation regulating the ICD, it may come to its notice, but we must make sure that such a report also be submitted so that the ICD can do its own kind of investigation and that it's not limited to the station commissioner, you know, where the complaint was dealt.
Is looking for that. I just want to say that the way the Act is framed now, what will happen is that it is a matter of last resort that the child will get a residential sentence. So all other options need to be considered first. There's an entire section on alternative sentences that the court must consider. So the child will go to a residential option, and that might be a child and youth care center, you know, the old secure care centers. That might happen to the child, where the child will go through a full educational program and that kind of thing. There will be rehabilitation programs and reintegration programs, because one of the principles underlying the Act is that of restorative justice. So, you know, the child will be prepared to go back into the community and be a proper citizen of the country, rather than being somebody who is removed. The child will go into prison as an absolute last resort, only where the child is over 14 years of age and where the child has committed a Schedule 3 offense and is a repeat offender. You know, those criteria need to be there. So the way the Act is designed is that everything else has to kick in first, and if at all possible, the child must be removed from the criminal justice system, and it will be a very few number of children that will actually go to trial, because the preliminary inquiry will sift out children who don't need to go to trial. Thank you.
You mentioned the programs at the center. Who is responsible for ensuring that those programs are implemented, as Honorable Bloom asked? Are other departments ready? Because I will mention two centers in the Free State, the Huzo in Bloemfontein and Madidi Matches in Kroonstad. When we visited them, the management complained that the programs can't be implemented because it is the responsibility of the Department of Education to employ teachers who are responsible for some of the programs.
I know DG will talk generally to the whether the ready departments are ready, but in particular on the educational program, the Department of Education provides programs for sentenced children in DCS facilities. In respect of unsentenced children, children who are still awaiting trial, that responsibility falls with the Department of Social Development. They ran a program for the last financial run these programs, I think in 6 different correctional facilities. That project has come to an end. And one of the things that we need to test after the coming into effect of this act is how many children will actually await trial in a prison after this. Because as I said, the act is very strict about which category of children can be remanded to await trial in a prison. So we anticipate that that number will drop drastically. The act also makes provision for a matter where a child is remanded to prison to come to court every 14 days. And, you know, to facilitate that matter within the court process, that court case will be prioritized. So if the act is properly implemented, that child won't be in prison awaiting trial for months on end. And the programs will be ad hoc, ABIS type programs that the child would need.
Can I also come back to one aspect? I think it was your question, sir, right at the beginning. I get a sense that your concern is that children are being sent away from home to these youth and child and youth care centres. Just to say a bit about that, Section 71 says, and as Ms. Moodley has indicated, compulsory residence sentences of compulsory residence are going to be the exception, hopefully. But if a child does need to go to either to a child and youth care centre or to prison, Section 71 requires a pre-sentence report, and it says where a probation officer recommends that a child be sentenced to compulsory residence in a child and youth care centre, providing a program referred to in Section 191(2) of the Children's Act, the recommendation must be supported by current and reliable information obtained by the probation officer from the person in charge of that centre regarding the availability or otherwise of accommodation of the child. I would like to think, and perhaps Ms. Moodley can come in here, because I haven't really been involved in the... I'm not too clued up on the Children's Act, but that whole process, I would like to think that when the probation officers do make recommendations like that, and depending on the availability of these child and youth care centres, that's taken into consideration. It's not always possible, I think, in practice, because there are not enough of these around everywhere. But that is something that is taken into consideration when a person is sent to a child and youth care centre.
Then on the state of readiness of department, I'd like to just give the committee the following comfort that to a greater extent, some of the interventions that are required by the Act have already been happening. They've just not been legislated and regulated. So we already have some probation officers. Some of these interventions that have been reported today already exist. What we are trying to do is to streamline them so that they are available throughout the country and they are available to the children that need these interventions. So insofar as then ensuring that is concerned, this legislation is going to be supported by a whole range of mechanisms, and I'm answering this question but trying to give you background, Honourable Mr. Bloom, of how, when we are saying state of readiness, there are, in my view, at least 5 things that will make this act to be implemented by the 1st of April, but we will monitor as the cluster responsible for this act very closely for the first year. At the very least, we will be meeting more than once. I think the legislation prescribes how we should meet. The five things that I'm referring to is really the state of readiness in terms of human personnel, the warm bodies that will ensure that all the things that we are saying will happen. The second element will be the governance framework, which is in place, and in certain areas where that governance framework is not in place, the intersectoral task team will then ensure that governance is in place, because that's the DGs are primarily responsible for ensuring that exists. The third issue refers to infrastructure and resources, and I think that's where I think the member's question was primarily focused on if there are programs that are required, those programs will be funded. What we've done is we've submitted some requests to National Treasury for financial resources to support us. Naturally, in this recession, we are not going to get the resources that we require. So what we've done is we've requested member departments to go back and streamline their baseline and try and find resources within the existing baseline. I think the only amount we have that is earmarked for this for now to get started is only 30 million. What we need in addition to the 30 million is another 30 million. I think it's 29 to be precise. But in addition to that, then each department will then find resources in the baseline, and the intersectoral committee of DGs will ensure that we monitor whether the funds are allocated in places where they should be allocated. In addition, we are also seeking donor funding. We already have some element of donor funding that is helping us run the program, but what we are trying to do is to get those programs sustainable through seeking further donor funding in instances where we are able to secure that so that we ensure that the programs are sustainable. The third element the fourth element of how we are going to ensure that the resources are in place and the system is able to run and the act comes into effect is really, amongst others, providing the training that is necessary. We met Honourable Member Mr. Bloom yesterday as the intersectoral committee to look at this, and we said we will have three phases really of training. The intermediary training would be your day-to-day type training that the police will require, that prosecutors, magistrates, and all of us will require in terms of managing the act. What we are saying is that it may make a lot of sense that we consolidate that type of training and we give people similar type of training, even though we may specialize in certain areas, because police deal with children on a day-to-day basis other than perhaps people like ourselves in this environment. So the short-term training, medium-term training, and then the third level of training is looking at the sustainability of the program, where we are saying as part of the training program, have curricula that is developed for universities, for police academies, for prosecutors in our Justice College, for instance, where this effective training will take place so that we sustain the act in the long term. So short term, we'll start with short term courses, but as we move along, we'll move to medium term courses. As we as we mature the implementation of the legislation, that's when we would then be looking at the long-term training. So, in terms then of your the question of the immediate readiness, we are comfortable as the Department of Justice and as the cluster that departments are as far as possible ready to implement this legislation by the 1st of April. I must, however, indicate the following so that there is no confusion in the House. The directives that have to be issued by the National Director of Public Prosecution have been submitted to the Minister for Consultation, Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development for consultation. He will be interacting with those directives now. It should be done in relative terms very soon. Before the actual implementation of the legislation. The National Commissioner has got to issue national instructions. We've interacted with the first preliminary instructions that were issued. We've made our comments formally to the National Commissioner, and they are now interacting with our comments. We already know, Chair, as we sit here, that the second round of draft instructions has already been populated and somewhat completed. What we do not have as we speak, and as we are sitting at this meeting, is the final set of instructions that would be issued by the Commissioner. But that process, we are comfortable that will be completed. It will not be in time, because the legislation is very specific on when these instructions must have been concluded before they're coming into effect of the legislation. Those instructions will not be out on time for the 1st of April. But what we've agreed, and with the guidance of the portfolio committee as well, is that in populating the instructions, we must guard against rushing to meet a deadline and have instructions that are ineffective. And therefore, the National Commissioner, as I understand it, Chair, will be issuing interim instructions whilst they are finalizing the detailed instructions that they will be issuing. So, and then the third element then relates to these regulations that we are here about today. And because they make the third layer of the information that must exist before the legislation comes into effect. My understanding, Chair, and in terms of the legislation, is that these regulations were meant to be tabled by the 1st of December. We were not able to meet that deadline. We are doing the last round of consultations, and today is one of those last round of consultations on these regulations. Beyond today, we then need to take the regulations back to the portfolio committee for finalization. Because the portfolio committee does not have the power in terms of the Act to amend regulations, we've taken all the comments that we've received from the portfolio committee, drafted them into the regulations as have been highlighted and square bracketed and everything that you see before the members right now. The next level is that once the members of the portfolio committee indicate, and as well as the members of this House indicate that they are happy with the regulations, what we then need to do, our minister needs to withdraw the regulations from Parliament and reinstate the finally agreed version as the version of the regulation. All of this, honourable members, I would submit, would happen and will happen before the end of before the end of March, in time for the implementation of legislation on the 1st of April. So overall, from a process perspective, there is some element of readiness. I must, though, hasten to add that this legislation is one of those very few pieces of legislation that are really, really expensive if you were to say you are going to implement it at the rate and pace at which we had wanted to implement it. But because of the reality of our finances and as inter-sector departments, we are of the view that the implementation on the 1st of April of this legislation will adopt a minimalist approach rather than the grand approach that we had thought we would roll out by 2010. And that's what I would like to end. It doesn't mean we will not implement, we'll just scale down in terms of what we had thought we would do initially when life was good. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I saw in one of the forms here that now the report should be provided within 30 days about within 30 days. I'm sure you get it. Now, take into account from the scene of crime. Let me talk from the scene of crime. Here is the children were playing, stabbed somebody with a bottle or a knife, seeing the blood, and then it was announced that your friend is dead. And then here is the police coming with a van at the scene, uniform. Now, bringing that fright to that particular child, that is taken to the place where you're going to take the child, whether to the community service center or to the, what do you call that place in another name now, where you see the child first. Okay. These 30 days, we think it will be suitable in order to compile a report, because every time when you go to a child, he or she will be crying. You know, those things. It also affects to adults before the court. How many are they cried before the magistrate? A lot of them. Okay. I heard only
Another question is the issue of expungement of sentences or something of the sort. I agree with the child that no, he or she can make an application for the expungement of sentence. But for the Director General to expunge that thing, can't we use a suitable word that to withdraw? Because the Director General won't be the owner of that, which those sentences has been passed it. Because this act, after the Director General got information about you can expand this thing, I'm failing to understand. Okay, can we be clarified? Thanks.
Honorable Bloom.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Chairperson, I want you to know that it seems that COPE is very much serious about justice. It's only two COPE members that is present at this meeting. Chairperson, with you as the chairperson. Chairperson, one of my questions were not answered. The determination of the age of the child, that is one. But I want to follow up on the response of readiness. Psychologists and social workers. How many social workers and psychologists do we have when this thing is implemented? Because they are going to play a very central role in this thing. Not the police, it's not the court, it is psychologists and social workers. And I know for a fact that the shortage in all the departments in the country of psychologists and social workers. Chairperson, but a very interesting thing was mentioned that the portfolio committee does not have any powers to amend the regulations. Now, my question will be now, Chairperson, why are we sitting here and discussing this regulation if we can't do anything on that? That's a question for clarification.
You can respond.
We will take the follow-up questions in the same way as we took the first round. May I start with Ted?
In respect of how many social workers, for the implementation of this act, what we really require are probation officers. And they are people who have a social work degree, but who are admitted in terms of the probation officer's legislation. And social developments have given us their current figures. They're operating at the moment with 484 full-time probation officers, 360 assistant probation officers, and 55 volunteer assistant probation officers. They are clear that they have a component that can carry through the work that is required in terms of this legislation. I think that's something that I need to say to the House as part of the history behind this piece of legislation is that it started being drafted in the year 2002, and it underwent many delays in its parliamentary process. And what happened in 2005 is that all the departments signed a protocol for the management of children awaiting trial. That protocol was signed at the highest level by the respective ministers, and the departments then started working. In fact, the operational ISCCJ slipped from 2005. So the departments have been working towards the implementation of this act in effect for many years now. And the putting in place of probation officers was one of the aspects that were covered. The psychologists, I would imagine, would only come in when the court determines that a psychologist is needed to investigate circumstances of this child because of particular problems that this child might be presenting with. And then it would be done on an ad hoc basis. And if it's in relation to the capacity of the child, the criminal capacity of the child, then I would imagine that is a court responsibility. And, you know, at the moment, we currently do use psychologists in respect of determining criminal capacity, sometimes even of adults. And, you know, that's the court responsibility, and we pay for those tests to be carried out. What else I wanted to say is, in respect of your question on age determination, if you look at the regulations, I think it is Form 4, speaks to the medical practitioner who does a... yes, it is Form 4, who does an examination, an age estimation or age determination of the child. And this is information that we have got from the medical practitioners themselves. And on Part C of the form, you would see that those are some of the things that the doctor would look at in trying to determine whether or not this child has capacity. And it would only go to a medical practitioner if the inquiry magistrate himself or herself can't make a determination in respect of age. And the way the inquiry magistrate will do this is that the probation officer must present all kinds of information before the magistrate, so that the magistrate must first be able to determine. And those things are, besides ID documents, baptismal certificates, a full report of the child, that somebody might have possession of, the priest, the local priest at the church where the child attends. Those people might all be able to contribute some information, and the magistrate will take that information first, orally, in order to determine the age of the child. And it's only when that fails and the magistrate feels that he needs a medical opinion that those children will be referred to a medical practitioner. Thank you.
With respect to the powers to amend the regulations, I guess we've been drafting legislation in a particular way, and maybe it's catching up with us. But if one looks at the provisions of Section 97, sub 2, it only refers to the tabling of regulations in Parliament for approval. It says nothing about the amendments and all of that. And so the practice generally, because most of the legislation has been drafted in this manner, is that the practice has been that if there are comments by members, those comments are definitely taken into account, but before the regulations are tabled as a formal and the final approved set of regulations by the Parliament, the minister would then withdraw and reinstate. So it doesn't mean that the comments are not taken into account, but they are, which is why I keep saying, in part, of course, we are seeking approval, but in part, it's also a consultative process, so that if there are further amendments that are being suggested by this House, we could then factor those amendments. The minister can then withdraw and reinstate with the effected amendments, and that's all I was trying to explain. Thank you, Chair.
Can I ask you to answer the question of the Honourable Member on expungement? The word expungement was used because we have to recognise that this child, there was a sentence imposed on this child. So to use the word withdrawal, we use currently in legal language, we use the word withdrawal when the prosecutor decides to withdraw the charges at any stage. So, you know, withdrawal would have been a confusing word to use. Expunge is generally the word that is used to wipe out a record. And that's really what happens here, is that the child does have a record, but we agree that in certain circumstances that record should be wiped out so that the child doesn't carry this through his adult life. You know, it might affect job applications and that kind of thing. So we give the child an opportunity, if he hasn't committed another offense and it was just something that went wrong, wrong once in his life, but he got saddled with this record, an opportunity to wipe out the record.
I understand but the accused person, so-called accused, the child, yes, can do that, I agree. My question was that, okay, if that is the Director General, may expand, that is my problem, or after getting the information, the information, because on a criminal person, it goes to the Minister of Justice, or to the State President, also, or one to expand those things. But here we are told that it's the Director General. I understand. I wanted just a clarity. Why the Director General? At the same time, in order to assist in my question of 30 days, page 42, you see the notes there where I describe the matter at the historic scene, page 41. Those who are going to answer, concentrate on the notes on page 42. Thanks, Chairperson.
Yes, I'm just going to add on the question of expungement, that if you look at Section 87 of the Act, the DG Justice doesn't actually expunge. The DG will, upon receiving the application, check whether the offence that the child is applying to be expunged is a Schedule 1 or Schedule offence, and also ascertain whether a period of 5 years or 10 years has expired from the date the child was convicted, and then we'll issue a certificate of expungement, and then that certificate will be submitted to the head of the Criminal Records Center, because they are the custodians of the criminal records, and then they will do the actual expungement. So the Minister of Justice or the Director of Justice will only, after satisfying him or herself that the conditions of expungement have been complied with the issue of a certificate. Can I also just add that the question of the expungement of records is different from the issue of the pardon by the State President? On the question of 30 days, the member raised, if you look at Section 11 of the Act, the court will refer a child to a suitable qualified person to evaluate the criminal capacity, and that person must provide the court with the report after doing the evaluation within 30 days from the date the court issues or refers the child to that person. Which is not from the date of the commission of the offence, because I think the member's concern was that from the investigation to that date, the time might not be sufficient. So it will be at the stage the court refers the child for the evaluation. Then the person who's doing the evaluation must provide the court with the report within 30 days.
Commissioner. My follow-up, it was in connection with the emotionality of that particular person. Now, that's why I said on page 42, on the notes there, if you can check there, it describes what I was saying, that taking into cognizance the moral, emotional, psychological, and the social development of that child. You know, those things, I was saying, 30 days, it would seem to be very little time to, you know, they said more time in order to give I can't pronounce this word, but the on-physical, you will pronounce it, because of my game. Yeah. To give that authenticity of the report, really, you must have those things quelled down, then you come up with the report of that. Because this report is meant for the purpose of sentencing, doing all of those things.
Yes.
Just on this one, I think we need to balance two things. I think the members' concerns, we share them, but we also need to balance the fact that you need to bring a matter to a close with reasonable speed so that there is certainty for the child and for everybody else. So we are balancing doing justice on the one hand, and I am sure that under exceptional circumstances, those circumstances must be exceptional where you find that you have all of those variables playing themselves out at the same time. So what is ideal in restorative justice and justice broadly is to ensure that you go through your processes as quickly as possible. Not that it doesn't mean that it should be thorough. It should no longer be thorough. It should still be thorough, but you must do that speedily so that the child has closure, the family has closure, and a further process, if it is necessary, a further process may still be undertaken in terms of restoring that justice and replacing that justice, that child back into society. So it's that fair balancing. We can't allow too long periods which will close the system, which is what we are trying to do, to narrow down the issues in the system. Thank you.
Witness for that engagement. Okay. Now let me take the opportunity to thank the DG and the team. Thank you very much for the presentation. It was very empowering, and we hope that next time we will be informed in time when there are issues of this nature that have to be processed quickly. Thank you very much.